Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the meaning of vampire stories, and why are they so popular right now? From the moody adolescent appeal of Stephenie Meyer's Twilight series to the violent and racy Charlaine Harris books that inspired HBO's True Blood, it would seem American audiences have developed an insatiable appetite for stories about bloodthirsty creatures of the night. So what makes vampire literature and film such enduring favorites, and how do they reflect the deepest fears and desires of the eras in which they are conceived and consumed? Joining us to talk about that are Gothic literature specialist Rochelle Christie, who teaches at UT Arlington, and cinema and television professor Rick Warland of SMU. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Does every culture have vampire stories?
I think the answer to that is no. It tends to be more of a relation through Eastern Europe and Southern Europe coming into Western Europe, and that became the basis for the vampire legends in Europe that eventually culminates in Bram Stoker writing Dracula in the late 1890s. But although there are various kinds of undead creatures and ghost-like things and bloodsuckers of various kinds, not exactly what we would think of as the vampire.
I was really interested to read that sometimes vampire stories were used to explain illnesses and diseases that medicine hadn't really explained yet, things like tuberculosis.
Right. I know with Bram Stoker's Dracula that it does kind of talk about the fear and anxiety, particularly of syphilis at the time in late Victorian England. And so the idea of, sort of the sexy things about vampires, sort of the blood exchange and things like that, that syphilis had to do with, and also the ideas of other sexy things. Yes. Yeah.
So it's like a man who comes at night and the woman has no choice really but to submit.
Contamination. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
What's really interesting now is that a lot of the current vampire stories feature a lot of female characters, and that's not that wasn't typical in the past, right?
Not really, at least in terms of the film genres, that the film versions of the vampire that came along. And I think it is really an interesting development that movies have started and books have started to move towards more female inclusion in the stories. And I think one way of saying it, if it was just as a quick soundbite, would be to say that the traditional male vampire story, male-centered vampire story like Dracula, is very much about sex. And the more female-centered story is, guess what? More about romance is how I would read it.
Well, I was really surprised. My kids wanted to read the Twilight series, so I wanted to check it out first because I knew nothing about it. I was surprised to crack that book open and find that it's a metaphor for the chastity movement.
Right, abstinence, right? Yes, basically vampires become a metaphor for the sort of teenage longing, right, of wanting to engage in sexual activity, but it's a taboo and that they actually are being told that they shouldn't. It's interesting that Bella is very much wanting to engage with Edward, and Edward sort of holds her back. He is the more traditional, he says, in my time. We just didn't move so fast, Bella. And she says to him, you're a bit of a relic. But it's kind of bringing back sort of those more traditional values of waiting. Edward wants to wait until they're married. So it's interesting. It's more of a conservative text than, say, Harris's, what has been now basically adapted into True Blood. So that's much more sexy and very different. I don't think you'd want your children to watch True Blood. I have a 3-year-old, and I don't, I wouldn't dare allow her to watch True Blood.
Have people who have liked these stories always also been sort of titillated by the blood, or is it really just the sex that draws people to these stories?
Oh, I think it's both, frankly, and it all depends on what is the kind of story that you want to tell. The horror genre generally and the vampire characters specifically are highly malleable, that there's all sorts of different variations that you can do of this type of story and these characters. And so to have the more sort of sexy, appealing vampires of recent vintage is completely within the paradigm that's meaningful for how this story works. But I think it's all with Dracula, starting with Dracula for sure, there's definitely always been this very potent mix of sexuality and violence that's central to the story.
To what extent did Dracula really make the mold for everything that came in the 20th century?
Ooh, Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, we're talking about 1897. It really drew from a lot of other Gothic texts before it, but I think that it is considered the quintessential vampire text that people keep going back to. Many of the things that Bram Stoker lays out in that novel, such as not being able to walk over running water. There's other things that he draws on as far as basically the way that vampires are propagated and things like that. So I think a lot of people go back to that text. It's a great text, not only for, you know, sexuality, as we're talking about, and kind of looking at some of those repressed sexual desires that Victorian England was dealing with, but also a lot of political concerns, which is also what a lot of contemporary Gothic vampire texts look into, political concerns as well. So it's not just about sex, but there's a lot of that in there, of course.
Go ahead.
Well, I think there's no question that novel, which was also very much adapted and changed and played with for more than 100 years, it's the paradigm. It's the basic model for how we think of as a vampire. And generally speaking, any subsequent vampire story or movie has to establish very early on, either I'm pretty much in this mode or I'm going against it in certain ways. And so in the first Twilight, which is the only one I've seen, we learn very soon up front that the vampires walk in the daytime. Now, in Bram Stoker's original novel, Dracula walks in the daytime too, but his powers are diminished. And that element of it almost got totally eliminated from any subsequent movies and our ideas about vampires. And at the climax of the first Twilight, there's a great scene where that takes place in a ballet studio. And we see the very bad tracker vampire corner Bella, and we see multiple reflections of him in the mirrors. And it's just saying, it's not like those stories you've learned. This is, vampires are even more dangerous than you'd thought. So.
Yeah, because in Bram Stoker's Dracula, there was no image in the mirror. Is that right?
There's no image. Yes. Jonathan is actually shaving himself, and Jonathan Harker goes over to Dracula's castle. And he's actually shaving himself, and there isn't a reflection there. And so Jonathan, that's one of Jonathan's first cues that perhaps there's something wrong with this character.
Yeah, what's so fascinating about, I think, the original, I shouldn't say the original, there were things that came before it, but about Bram Stoker's Dracula is this growing dread that Harker has, that something is wrong, and he doesn't quite know what it is at first, and this guy seems to be a pretty gracious host, right? And they're going to do a business transaction of some kind?
Right. Well, actually, what Dracula's doing is he's acquiring land around, properties around London.
He's just investing in real estate.
Oh, of course. Just an investment.
Some modern-day parallels
right
there.
But, I mean, actually, he's planning an invasion on the seat of, you know, basically the British Empire, which is London. And so for viewers, that's a scary idea. He comes to the most populated, you know, city in London. I mean, I'm sorry, in England, and he's basically going to go stalk and, you know, feed on people. So yes.
So let's talk about the film Vampire that really set this whole thing in motion. I guess that must have been Murnau's Nosferatu.
Yes.
He wanted to tell the original Bram Stoker story, and Bram Stoker's widow said no.
Well, not exactly in that sense, because he never asked her. F.W. Murnau, the German director, really important German director of the 1920s and early 30s, they wanted to do an adaptation of Dracula, but they didn't. I think they assumed it was in the public domain, and or they assumed they could get away with it. So they called the characters slightly by different names. They located it to Germany. They made the image of the vampire Nosferatu look more like an alien creature and not at all like the courtly gentleman that Bela Lugosi would play. But it's the situations and characters of Dracula that this guy is sent on. The real estate agent is sent to the castle. He travels. Takes him a while to get there. There's a madman that's the Renfield character who's already been infected. He's imprisoned in the castle. The vampire becomes fascinated with his wife and returns to his hometown by ship, kills everyone on the ship, etc. So visually, Nosferatu is just a beautiful film. And there's, in fact, actually in Twilight, there's a kind of montage sequence where Bella is doing research using Google, of course, and learning all about vampires. And as part of this sort of quick montage, we end up with just a kind of film frame shot of Max Schreck as the vampire from Nosferatu. to.
Was Nosferatu the last ugly vampire that we've seen? Because it seems like Hollywood has treated most of them. They're screen gods.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably so. I mean, I think as in the Francis Ford Coppola, Bram Stoker's Dracula, as I always just love calling it Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, because I just think that's funny. But in that film and many of the others, you typically see the sort of handsome, good looking, courteous person, and then there's some level of monster that is displayed through makeup and performance that appears underneath it.
Shelley, when did we start seeing writers dealing with the tortured vampire, the person who hates what he has become but has no power to control it?
Well, there was some evidence of that in the 19th century, but very few cases. There was a little bit of maybe you were sympathetic with a vampire, but that was far and few between. There's been a big shift in how we look at vampires. We're more sympathetic to them. And I think that has to deal with some of our own sort of societies of thinking about difference and thinking about ideas of, you know, otherness, and kind of playing around with those ideas, being more accepting of otherness. And we have to think of, you know, historically, when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, there was a lot of sense of invasion, a lot of idea of reverse colonization. Britain was really struggling with sort of losing its power as a world power. And I think for us today, I think we kind of think about difference where we embrace it more than perhaps the Victorians did. So I think the idea of the vampire becomes a metaphor for difference and how we can kind of basically embrace that and maybe think about that a little bit differently than people in the past have.
Yeah, it makes sense, too, that Stoker was writing decades before the sort of Freudian revolution, where people started thinking everybody's a little off and we have to just find a way to deal with that.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, that Dracula is portrayed in the first, in the original novel, as very much a kind of dangerous other, even though he is this nobleman himself and should fit in with the late Victorian society. But there are often moments in the Bela Lugosi version of Dracula. There's a couple of moments, and there's a famous line where Dracula says and I'm not going to do the Lugosi impression, but it's hard to resist, by the way. But he says, "To die, to be truly dead, that must be glorious." And so there's just a moment of pathos that the character displays.
It's interesting because vampires, we know they need blood to survive, but the only way they can be killed, they never get starved out in any of these stories. Someone always has to take action and do some special magical thing to eliminate them.
Well, in True Blood recently in the third series, last episode, basically one of the vampires is going to be starved out. So we kind of sort of see that happening. But yes, there's lots of different ways to kill a vampire. And we kind of see those different ways cropping up within the literature and within film and things like that. So, yeah.
We're talking about vampires in film and in literature with Rochelle Christie, who is a Gothic literature specialist from UTA, and Rick Warland, professor of cinema and television at SMU. You can join our conversation now. Maybe tell us about your favorite scary stories by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Rick Warland, who is professor of cinema and television at SMU, and Rochelle Christie, a Gothic literature specialist who teaches at UT Arlington. You can join our conversation about vampires in popular culture and what they say about us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. So what is the reason that right now, is it the economy? Is it things that are changing socially? Why do you think that now there are so many vampire properties? Or is it just imitation that one hit it really big and everybody else wants a similar story out there?
On the one hand, I think there is an upsurge in vampires. So if we're buying stock in vampires, the market's quite good. But on the other hand, at least since the film version of Dracula in the United States in 1931, they've really never gone away. Mm-hmm. There's always been some kind of a reliable vampire story of some kind or another, or a series or individual movies that have always been there for at least that long. And if you want to go back to, again, the source novel, then you can say it's really been, which is almost at the birth of really kind of commercial popular culture. It's right at the beginning of that. This is the latest phase, for sure.
Yeah, I would say that literary critics will say that the Gothic emerges most prominently in times of anxiety, cultural anxiety, and in times when the social sort of thinking is shifting. So I think it's really interesting that we are getting sort of this vampire upsurge. What is going on? Gothic texts are cultural texts. Basically, they are texts that respond to their environment. So I think that we can really look at them critically and ask, what kind of issues are texts like, you know, Stephanie Meyer's Twilight, True Blood, you know, the Sookie Stackhouse series, what kind of issues are they taking up? And perhaps in some ways we kind of need to take notice of what is going on around us.
The other thing that struck me is that at least recently a lot of these films have been taken from books, but all the people you see depicted on screen are spectacularly gorgeous human beings made to look like vampires. And I thought about our kind of Botox, cosmetic surgery, nose job culture, and vampires never age. And there's that sense that, you know, what have you traded away to be young and beautiful forever? And I wonder if that's occurred to either of you.
Well, that is a good point. And again, it comes back to immortality sounds like a great idea until we're faced with it.
Yeah.
that story has been done per se in different forms, because what if you were immortal, but of course everyone else isn't? And so you would constantly be losing people and just going forward. And there's actually kind of a funny bit in Twilight when Bella goes to Edward's house to meet his family, which I thought was a hilariously great scene.
They're all really hungry for her.
They really kind of want her. They're using the kitchen for the first time because they're trying to be nice and prepare food for her. But at one point, they go upstairs and they have this huge display on the wall of all of these graduation caps and tassels. And Edward says, well, this is kind of a family joke because we've all graduated quite a lot. So, I mean, I think the fact that, yeah, preserving eternal beauty, but of course it's always related to the vampire only becomes or is restored to youth and vitality by drinking blood. And so there is that ambivalence that often comes in those kind of stories of the vampire.
Also, too, if you think about Twilight and the audience, I mean, it's a teenage audience, really. And the idea that Edward, I mean, it seems agonizing to us that we have to repeat high school all the time, you know, referring back to all those graduation caps.
You're right. I thought of it in those terms. That is a horrible thing. Yes.
Goodness. Yeah. But you get the chance to do it over and over again, and you would probably be the popular kid, right, on the block, hopefully, if you've gone to high school that many times. And the idea of having that perfect high school experience, you know, that I think that some teenagers really respond to in certain ways.
And it's also the fact, I mean, it isn't everyone's experience. It isn't a living hell for everyone, but it is for some people, of course. And the appeal of these stories is all the characters. I mean, when Bella first comes to the high school, all things considered, she's instantly accepted. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a little bit of teasing and playing around with her and so on, but she's instantly accepted. And, of course, she's quite good looking. And all the kids in the school are quite good looking. Nobody is particularly nasty and vindictive within the school. They think the vampire clan is a little odd, but in fact they are. And there's a kind of it's almost the reverse of the bad high school experience, because it's the high school and her group of friends are all very congenial, and then the love life issues are about, well, he's a vampire.
It is sort of the ultimate fantasy, too, I think, for a teenage girl, in that so she gets her bad boy, and yet, on the other hand, he couldn't be less the guy who pressures her into doing. She's right. The one, in fact, who's pushing for, you know, to be much more involved with him, and he is sort of more refined than she is, and so you get that sense of danger and also that sense that ultimately you're taken care of.
And there's this seemingly this endless supply of young actors who look like James Dean in every generation. They've groomed, you know, a couple to be in these kind of movies.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Zach in Fort Worth. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, go right ahead, please.
I wonder if your guest comment on how Anne Rice's vampire series fit into the changing nature of depiction of vampire literature and film.
Yeah, first book was 1976. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. As far as literature goes, I mean, I really think that, and I'm blanking on his name right now. What is his name?
Lestat.
I'm not thinking about Lestat. I'm thinking about the other.
Louis?
Yes, Louis. Mm-hmm. Yes. He is the sympathetic vampire, right? He is one of the very first vampires where we start seeing that sort of sympathetic sort of human nature that can still exist within a vampire after they are turned, which I think is really interesting.
Now, that's a good point. And also back to our discussion about the particular times in which vampire stories become popular. The Anne Rice novels were hugely successful in the 70s and 80s, along with Stephen King. And yet, for various reasons, and I'm sure it's convoluted Hollywood reasons involving lots of money, we don't get a film version of that book until 1994, which actually mm-hmm. turned up very well. But it seems like it must have been at that point that suddenly that kind of version of essentially Dracula without a Dr. Van Helsing is really what that interview with the vampire is.
Did it reflect a different zeitgeist, having been produced in 1994, the film about a book that was written in 1976?
I've heard that Anne Rice was not happy with the film at all. And I think some of the film, as I look at it, and I've taught the film in my courses, that the idea of that sexuality was really being explored in the 1990s. I mean, it's always been explored. But the idea of Louis and Lestat having this very young, perhaps, daughter, and we were looking at alternative families. Mm. I know that has come out in my, you know, when I've been teaching
really
this particular text. And so we're kind of looking at the different ways that families are structured. And that's what I know my students find particularly interesting about that film. And also kind of the queer relationship between Louis and Lestat, too, that comes to the forefront in the movie in particular.
Yeah, in fact, Anne Rice, what she sort of played it both ways. She first publicly denounced the casting of Tom Cruise because she thought he was too much sort of the guy, the fighter pilot from Top Gun still. Mm-hmm. And then when the movie came out, she essentially apologized and said she thought he did a good job. So that was polite, if nothing else, if that was her true feelings. But I think you're right. And also these back to the idea that the female-centered narratives and the interest in romance, I think there's no question that these more recent stories are about family, because the very beginning of Twilight, we established that Bella's parents are divorced. She actually likes her stepfather and has a little more trouble with her actual father. And so her being shuttled back and forth between the two, her biological parents, is really important to the story.
People have talked about the fact that Bella, though, is very passive in some ways, as compared with Buffy the Vampire Slayer a decade earlier.
I think so. I think that Bella has certain agency. She's smart. There's certain areas that she can sort of. There's areas that she can't tread into. Let's just be honest about that. She can't seem to protect herself. Edward keeps having to protect her all the time. Edward says, "Don't hurt yourself." She keeps falling. and there's things like that. She reminds me a lot of Mina Harker, to be honest, in Bram Stoker's Dracula. Mm-hmm. Mina actually has a lot of knowledge. She comes up with a lot of the plans to get what we call in literary studies the crew of light over to Dracula's castle to eventually kill him. But she's left out of a lot of the plans. Bella, too, is left out of a lot of the things that could possibly hurt her. Edward doesn't want to tell her certain things. And that's the same thing that happened with Mina Harker. And eventually, because Mina is not told that Dracula is nearby, she's vamped by Dracula. So
vamped, I like that.
Yeah, it leads to her demise in certain ways. So I think that she is not as powerful as Buffy. Buffy was in the 1990s with girl power, mm-hmm. right? And Buffy could take care of herself. In fact, she was the designated one to slay vampires. And she was a young blonde cheerleader. So we weren't really expecting that. Joss Whedon talks about that. And he said, I wanted to make a character where you really didn't expect that she could really come and, you know, basically stake the vampires. So, yeah.
We have an email here from Jay who writes, I teach a course in zombies, vampires, and aliens. My college students seem to be unclear that vampires are fictional. What is going on with this? Have you guys experienced this in your classes? Really?
Yes, I have. I had a student come in, I shouldn't say that, but with fangs. Oh, I've had more than one, actually. and tell me that there is a vamp lifestyle. So
are these
yes.
like goth kids who have dyed their hair black and wear the white makeup? And
No. So it's interesting. Yes, I would like to talk more to basically the person who emailed in about thinking that their students basically think that they're vampires. Yeah.
Well, and I think in these recent books and shows can even be contributing to that because they're all about how the vampires are in as many ways as not normal. They're just part of similar society. So the one thing that I liked in the movie, I thought was very effective. In an earlier scene, Bella's father and the Indian boy and his father,
Jacob, werewolf.
Who is going to be a werewolf, come over to the house to watch the Mariners game. And they've got beer and the guys are going to hang out and watch the Mariners game. Later in the movie, the vampires play baseball. And it's a funny scene. And there is just this complete... It's just two different versions of negotiating. Well, both of these families like baseball. So they're normal.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to John in Richardson. Hey, John.
Hi there. I've been listening for just a bit. I don't know if anyone has brought up The Vampire by John Polidori. And I also wanted to ask if either of the commentators have seen Let the Right One In, the Swedish vampire film that won mad accolades, I believe, about a year and a half ago.
And there's an American translation in production.
Yeah, that one's Let Me In.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's in theaters now, I believe. I wanted to know, because I've heard a lot of discussion about Twilight, and the Let the Right One In is a very different ripple as far as my knowledge of you know, vampire films and books go, in that a relationship develops between a mortal boy who's about 12 and a vampire girl who is also 12. And I just wanted to know if either of them were familiar with it and would like to comment on it.
Yeah, let's get a response.
I'll take my,
thanks.
Comments on the air. Thank you.
And this vampire girl's been 12 for a long time, which is the famous line, right, in the film?
Well, yeah, it's the boy that's the vampire. And it's the other word. It's she's been the girl is a vampire, and she's been she has been a vampire for a long time. The original Swedish version of the film is wonderful. My daughter, who likes vampire films and horror things, dragged me to see it, and it was like thank you when that was over because it was beautifully shot. It's beautifully paced. There's production design is astonishingly good. It feels very much like some of the best examples of those sort of slowly but deliberately paced European art cinema films of the 50s and 60s. And yet it's, again, completely set in this world of the family turmoil. The boy's parents are divorced. The boy's father is implicitly gay and living with his lover. It's not quite spelled out, but this is what's going on in the story. It's about this boy being bullied in high school. And for anyone who was ever bullied in high school, it has the most satisfying climax ever.
It sounds like in that film, the vampire narrative is maybe the least complicated thing in this kid's life.
Well, it's one of them, and it increasingly it comes back to the things that really that we've talked about is that what is the price of doing this, and that increasingly I hate to ruin it for people, but spoiler alert. But what happens is the boy is essentially being recruited by the girl to be her caretaker during the day. And there's an amazingly kind of graphic scene, but of the previous caretaker, who's an old man essentially, and it's very clear through the whole setup of the story that this man who's has to go out and procure victims for her, this man was the boy himself 40, 50 years in the past.
We have an email here from Glenn in Arlington who wants to know, what is the significance of the werewolf vampire rivalry?
Oh, goodness. We see that in Bram Stoker, don't we? That Dracula actually has control over the werewolves. And, I mean, I think part of that is a class issue on certain levels, right? Of Dracula's royalty, the werewolves are sort of his basically henchmen, you know, weremen, however you would want to say that. But we also see that in True Blood, too. And where the vampires have control of the werewolf. So it's kind of the hierarchies in society, I think. And I think that it's a really interesting connection there. It's a good question.
And I think it is, because that trope keeps showing up now again and again in various formats. And oftentimes when we have those kind of vampire versus werewolf wars, our sympathies are with the werewolf, I think, because the werewolf is much of the time human. And the vampire is always the supernatural creature. And I think it's almost a kind of Apollonian Dionysian element that the werewolf is very instinctual, and they live in the forest and run on all fours and hunt animals and so on when they're not going after people. And vampires are these sort of high-class, educated put down people who look down on the humans. And so
right,
on.
They're the loyal dog.
Yeah.
Rick Warland from SMU and Rochelle Christie from UTA are here. We're talking about vampires and now werewolves in popular culture and what they say about us. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Gothic literature specialist Rochelle Christie of UTA and Rick Warland, who is professor of cinema and television at SMU. We're talking about vampires in popular culture. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Shelley, before the break, you were talking about the fact, a few minutes before the break, that part of Bram Stoker's Dracula was dealing with this fear of the loss of all this colonial power in England. We have an email here from Jim in Arlington who wants to know, what was the climate like with regard to immigration in England at the time of Stoker's novel? It has always struck me as a sort of anti-immigration allegory.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, you know, Jack the Ripper was basically in 1888. With Jack the Ripper, they believe that in Whitechapel, that was a highly, there were a lot of people of Jewish descent, basically. And you know, a lot of different sort of ethnicities living in that area. It was somewhat considered a slum. And so basically, there was a lot of anxiety. They said that that Jack the Ripper at one point was a Jewish butcher, and the Jewish butchers came out and said, no, it's not us. Take that back. And basically that there wasn't a lot of anxiety about all of these immigrants sort of flowing into the country and basically changing the cultural landscape. And also the idea of blood, right? We have the idea of race, ethnicity, and blood, and the idea that the classes at that time were intermingling, races were intermingling, the landscape was changing. And so there was some fear of that. And yes, and so part of that, Bram Stoker, people have said, has drawn from the Jack the Ripper cases. So
it's this idea that you become the thing you fear the most when you mix your blood with its blood.
Certainly, mm-hmm. Yes.
And actually, along those lines, the thing that's interesting about Jack the Ripper is that the Jack the Ripper case happened about 2 years after the publication of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And there was an actual first theater adaptation of Jekyll and Hyde was being done on the London stage. And I've read this in a couple of different places, and one source I find more reputable and believable than another. But apparently someone said, I think it's this actor who's playing Jekyll and Hyde, who's making the transformation on stage every night. And apparently that actor was actually questioned by the police. But even so, that's another way of indicating how all of the kind of archetypal stories of Frankenstein, Dracula, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde often intertwine in different ways. So that's oftentimes that is the Jekyll and Hyde is a werewolf story. It's a transformation story itself.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Brian in Fort Worth. Hi, Brian.
Hello, yes. I just personally don't believe in anything supernatural, so naturally, to me, vampires are just a man-made concept. And I enjoy the vampire movies, books, and I love True Blood. But when I watch True Blood or any of them, no matter how much I sit there and tell myself that's an actor, that's makeup, those are false teeth, I still feel, and being a rational person, anxiety. And it's probably a very complex answer of why a rational person can sit there and still does this whole vampire concept make you feel uncomfortable. It's probably complex. I mean, could it be, can you summarize that, or is it just something as simple as you know they're going to strike, you just don't know when?
Well, it sounds like empathy, certainly. Is there more to it than that?
Well, I think it's definitely complicated, and it's also complicated in terms of particular movies or books by aesthetics, as how skillful and creative the filmmakers are who give you these variations on the same story that you've seen before. I think it is mixed up with childhood fears that we fully, there's a lot of times we get interested or we're told fairy tales when we're children, right very much at the point of a development in which it's small children don't always quite understand the difference between make-believe and reality or something I would like to have happen versus what could happen. So those childhood fears are never far behind beneath any kind of horror narrative, and that kind of, you know, basic physiological evolutionary fear of things that could hurt us and just being wary. We know it will strike, as you say.
Well, it also seems like this trend to looking at some of these things that we used to just patently call monsters and having some sympathy for them also gives us this really uncomfortable sense that we identify with someone that we know is about to kill somebody. You know, if it's a main character somewhere that's a murderer or a vampire or a werewolf and we kind of like them and yet we know they're about to do something really wrong. I even think it's funny to say this, but about The Sopranos, where you really, you know, Tony Soprano was horrible. He never did anything right, but he was this character that you still sort of had come to identify with by watching the series.
There was actually a long that I'd never thought about that, but I think you're right. It's there's the case of the one episode where the psychiatrist that he was always speaking to was raped, and there was an episode of her saying, and I think there's a, I can't remember, but I think that she has a dream or something like that, or a fantasy that she knows that Tony's essentially a killer, and he's my friend in essence, and I can have this guy completely eliminated. So
I think it's also the complex idea. And I know with True Blood, there's always this sort of idea of this shifting moral compass in True Blood. And I think that there's good and bad in all of us. We're taught to repress the bad, right? But we see in True Blood with Vampire Bill that he is good. He's trying to protect Sookie. We have all this compassion for him. And then he goes out and he, you know, basically kills a stripper. You know, and so I think in some ways there is that uncomfortable identification. And I think that Alan Ball, who is a writer and producer, I think that he is trying to do that in certain ways and to get us to question who we are and at the heart of it all.
Like, don't get so comfortable thinking that you're on the moral high road.
Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ellis in North Dallas. Hi, Ellis.
Hi. Thank you for letting me on. Montague Summers, an English Roman Catholic priest, wrote a book, The Vampire in Europe, where he goes back over the centuries and traces a vampire. But he believed in it, but these are legends from usually in Eastern Europe or Central Europe going down into Greece. And you get the impression, and at one time, the vampire was the embodiment of evil, someone who got his powers by a compact with the devil and to get eternal life. And I'm wondering if today, now you have romantic figures, if it isn't related to sort of a breakdown of conventional morality, where we suddenly, you know, veer toward, you know, the exotic. You know, you have 40% of all children born today are the single mothers. And you see this in film, popular culture, that, you know, it isn't, you know, it's the breakdown.
Yeah, it's hard to sort of put your finger on where wrong begins and right ends or vice versa.
Well, I think that the Gothic genre fills the gap between point A to point B. And let me try to explain what I mean by this. I think the Gothic has a way of sort of playing around with the ideas of good and evil and allowing us to role play with those ideas. It's a fantasy genre. And I don't know if I can, you know, really speak to the morality of Gothic text and sort of the immorality probably of Gothic text. But I know that when the Gothic emerges most prominently, like I said before, that we get this idea of more Gothic text and we get this idea of kind of working through these social anxieties. And so perhaps maybe we are in a situation right now where our world is changing, and perhaps Gothic texts are coming up to sort of address that and help us work through it. I know Gothic texts can be very conservative. Stephanie Meyer's Twilight is considered a conservative text. And, for example, True Blood is considered a very far left text. So the Gothic is malleable. It can basically work for morality or, I don't know, immorality. I'm not going to call True Blood immoral, but, you know, I'm not going to go there. But I think that it can do lots of things. But I think it's part of figuring out some of those anxieties. And as we move to point B, every society is going to change.
We talked earlier about the Swedish film Let the Right One In, and someone is writing in to tell us that it's actually showing at the Texas Theater in Dallas this Saturday at 7. It's, you know,
great.
Cliff, so you might want to, if you haven't seen the film,
great
you check
to see
it out
on the big screen.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. As opposed to Netflix. Let's see, we have, we'll go back to the phones now, and let's go to Stephen McKinney. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is that I was wondering if your panelists had ever taken the time to draw a comparison and contrast with the vampire mythos to something more recent. There were, you know, the Highlander book series and TV series and movies also dealt a lot with the immortality and the issues that you face when you're immortal, but it humanized it a little more by taking the character of the vampire and making them an immortal human. And I was wondering if they had ever looked at that and you know, just drawn the comparison between the two types of characters.
Well, let's find out.
Well, I think that there is, when I teach classes on horror or science fiction, I always note that there's a great deal of overlap between three particular forms, which are horror, science fiction, and fantasy. Fantasy is rooted in ancient mythology, which is one of the reasons I think that in fantasy stories, swords show up a lot. Swords and magic show up a lot in fantasy genres. So the Highlander is essentially a swordsman. And again, these particular forms are related. And there's a moment, I keep coming back to Twilight, but there's a moment early on in Twilight in the movie where Bella says to Edward, "I keep thinking, trying to figure out who you are, and I keep thinking about kryptonite and radioactive spiders." And, you know, Superman and Spider-Man, and referencing the comic book heroes, which are very much in the fantasy vein. And he says, well, something like, well, what if I'm not either of those, or what if I'm essentially the super villain? So I thought that, but another element of the fantasy that also plays into horror as well, this role-playing idea that we were just talking about, is the idea of secret identities of one kind or another. There's another part of us, well, Jekyll and Hyde, maybe not that extreme, but other elements of us, of our personalities, which if we're lucky are multifaceted, and we have parts of ourselves that we don't show everyone. And just that, and again, for adolescents especially, that's so important that there is this real me that nobody understands.
And I guess there's also the danger to it because you can't fully know anyone that you think you know. I'm curious as to whether either one of you has a particular movie or TV series or book that you have really enjoyed that the people who like this genre might check out that they might not have heard of in the past or that they might want to go back to.
I'm thinking.
Oh, well, in terms of films, I think I'm glad we've talked about Let the Right One In because it is a really good movie. I very much like the Hammer films of the 60s with Christopher Lee as Dracula. I think they vary a little bit, but those are actually very good. And this is extremely cultish from when I was a kid, and there's a lot of us of a certain age who remember Dark Shadows, the ABC television series about whose central character was a vampire, and it was a five-day-a-week soap opera. And, wow, what an amazing work.
I'm guessing you can find that on Netflix now pretty easily.
Yes, the entire series. It's virtually the only soap opera. I think there was about 1,000 episodes. It was on for 5 years, and you can watch the entire show, half-hour segments, about 1,000 of them.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, you know, I study Victorian literature, so I'll take you back to the 1890s. And I would encourage people to really get into some of the more obscure Gothic texts by Clemence Halsman. She has a text, a novella called The Werewolf. It's about a female werewolf. It has some interesting Christian motifs in it. And I think a lot of people, I know my students have enjoyed that particular text. Vernon Lee has some great texts about very strong, if you're into femme fatales, Vernon Lee is the author for you. And also, I really do like True Blood right now. And I think that the vampire politics in True Blood are really interesting. If you can get past some of the sexier scenes, sometimes it does go a little bit too far. But I think what it is trying to say to its viewers is interesting. You might not agree with it all, but it's interesting.
Rochelle Christie is a Gothic literature specialist. She teaches at UT Arlington. Rick Warland is professor of cinema and television at SMU. It's been a great conversation, Shelley and Rick. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you
for having us.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.